Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. This is Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week for you to listen on the weekend in case you missed them. And, of course, you can find all our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Brian Lehrer. Anyway, enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio on Monday morning at 10 a.m. on WNYC. Have a great weekend. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And if you're young and uninsured, Uncle Sam wants you by next Monday. This is a big week for the Affordable Care Act. For most uninsured Americans, next Monday, March 31st, is the deadline to buy a policy or face a fine. It's mostly younger, healthier, uninsured people who are holding out. The government announced an extension for some people yesterday, but not for most. And of particular interest to young single people, there was more Obamacare contraception coverage action at the Supreme Court yesterday, with implications for much more than health care, too. The question, can a for-profit company exempt itself from the laws of the land based on religious objections? Can a corporation, as opposed to a person, even be recognized as having a religion? So with us for an Affordable Care Act update and to take your questions if you're not sure how this deadline affects you is Susan Dentzer, Senior Policy Advisor to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, formerly Editor-in-Chief of the journal Health Affairs and Health Policy Analyst for the PBS NewsHour. Hi, Susan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you, Brian.
And listeners, our phones are open at 212-433-WNYC for your Affordable Care Act deadline questions. Susan, can you remind us of the consequences of failing to have health insurance? We'll review in a minute who is required to buy a policy by Monday, but what's at stake for those who are required and don't do it?
If you essentially cannot qualify for any of a number of exemptions, that is to say, you can apply to the government for a so-called hardship exemption in certain circumstances. You can apply for an affordability exemption. And you can also apply for an exemption on the basis of religious belief.
And I want to go over those exemptions in a little more depth later. But assuming you don't qualify
sure.
for one of those exemptions.
Well, and sorry it takes a while to get to this, but assuming you don't qualify for any of those things, you are subject then to a penalty if you do not have health insurance, which will mean that next year when you file your tax return, due April 15th of 2015, you're going to have to check a box that says that you've got health insurance or not, and potentially you will need, if audited, to provide proof of that. If you can't show that, you will be subject to the penalty, and the penalty is equal to $95 per individual or 1% of income, whichever is greater.
Of your taxable income?
Of your taxable income.
So 1% of your taxable income. If you make $50,000 of taxable income this year, your tax bill would go up by $500.
Exactly.
More than the $95. If you're at the average income for Americans, which is about $50,000, $100,000 of taxable income, it goes up by $1,000, et cetera. Are we seeing yet whether that formula is high enough to act as an incentive? Let's say you're a young single person, 30 years old, making $50,000. What does the cheapest insurance policy cost after whatever government subsidy that person would qualify for? Do you happen to know that number?
It's going to be highly dependent, obviously, on whether you're eligible for any subsidies through the exchange when you're buying coverage.
Right. But is that dependent on income and family status? So, for example, is it a simply knowable number if we were to look it up to say if you're 30 years old and you're making $50,000 and you're single, you will qualify for X dollars in government subsidy toward your policy?
Yes, you could find that out. The truth of the matter is most likely that you would not be qualified. At $50,000, you would probably not be qualified for a subsidy. And the point is, in essence, health insurance is still going to be more expensive than paying that penalty. There's no question about it for many, many individuals. I think the broader point here, two points really. One is, it is true that the mandate penalties are relatively lower than many people would have liked. And the insurance community in particular felt that the penalties needed to be higher to really spur people to buy coverage. That's unarguably true. However, it is also the case that if we look at the one example that we have in the United States of these penalties being in place and what the effect was on people buying coverage, which is Massachusetts. Massachusetts also had a very low penalty in the early days of its health insurance reform, but we now look at that state and 98% of people in the state are covered. So what it tells you is that the penalty doesn't have to be particularly big to spur a lot of movement to coverage. And what those who looked at the Massachusetts situation conclude is that the big change was not the threat of the financial penalty. The big change was that the social norm, if you will, got altered, and that all of the discussion about having health insurance, the new avenues that were created through the existence of a new exchange, everything that was in the ether about having health insurance and why it was necessary to have that and desirable to have that, that caused a social shift, and that the expectation on the part of many people became not how can I get away with not having health insurance, but don't I really need to have this, and isn't the penalty just another reason to prompt me to enroll in health insurance?
So we'll see, as one of the fundamental questions here, whether that takes hold as a cultural norm nationwide as it did in Massachusetts. Let's take a phone call.
Absolutely.
Jane in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jane.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call. So my question is regarding if I get health insurance, I'm looking for work, and I really don't want to go through the rigmarole of signing up for additional health care if I'm going to then have a benefits package coming my way. So say if in June I got, a job with benefits, and then come April 2015 I'm able to check the box, would it make a difference if I hadn't been insured from January to June?
There is an ability in the law to have a sort of a comfort zone. I shouldn't say the law, but it's really the regulations that have been set. So I believe the answer is you would not be subject to a penalty in that instance. But frankly, it is worth checking this out if you're really interested and desperate to avoid even $95. It's probably worth talking to one of the enrollment counselors on, if you're in New York State, you can call the New York State Exchange and ask about that, or you can also submit a question to healthcare.gov.
Jane, why wouldn't you want to sign up for insurance?
Well, currently I am in an independent contractor role, mm-hmm. and it's a real estate position. It has not been lucrative this year at all. So it's just very hard for me to show income or ways of showing income, and looking for work full time. This is just sort of something that's kind of like been in my way that I have to deal with. But I'd much rather work on the full solution to the problem, which is a job with a benefits package.
Right. Make sure you.
I will say, if you're not showing any income, you're probably. Are you in New York State?
Mm-hmm.
You're probably eligible for Medicaid. So you have really very little to lose
right.
by signing up for coverage.
Okay.
Jane, good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ibrahim in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Ibrahim.
Yeah, hi, good morning, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I'm sorry, my voice is a little husky. I got some cold. I'm a cab driver, okay? And last weekend, the Taxi Workers Alliance had a fair for us where they had a group of people, I think from Emblem, who came in to help us sign up for the health insurance. This is something we desperately need. But when I started the process, according to the lady who was helping me, they only go by gross income. my gross income includes my lease, it includes my gas expense, it includes several other expenses. So when I file my taxes, I do the Schedule C itemized deduction. So I think they should go by the adjustable gross income, which is a taxable income, instead of going according to the gross income.
Right. And Ibrahim, that's a fascinating question. And I think we learned, Susan, from you earlier that they go by the adjusted taxable income for what your penalty would be if you don't have health insurance. But he's making it sound like they go by your gross income for determining what your subsidy would be. Do you know?
Yes. Well, this is an area of great confusion because there are different income standards in different parts of the law. For example, in Medicaid, the number used is the modified adjusted gross income. There are two questions here. One is what your actual subsidy is going to end up being, and the other question is what have you been told that your subsidy is. I would say just go ahead and proceed through the process and see, because there are preliminary estimates made about what your subsidy might be that might be different from what your actual subsidy would be.
Because the website, now that it's actually working, presumably, is going to give him maybe a more accurate reading on his subsidy than the person he spoke to?
Oh, quite possibly.
Ibrahim, good luck. Let's talk about some of the exempt groups, people who can remain uninsured and not pay the tax penalty, including, I've read, 14 categories of hardship exemptions, like for being homeless or having a death in the family or filing for bankruptcy. Are those the main ones?
There are three classes of exemptions. One is the hardship ones that you just mentioned. And there are quite a number of categories there. And all of that, by the way, I should say, HHS.gov does have excellent information about this on its website. So those who really want to dig deeply into these areas can find information about that. But that is one class of exemptions, is the hardship exemptions. The others are the affordability exemptions, and that has to do with your income and whether you're able to find or whether you're offered an insurance policy that is within a certain parameter of your income.
Oh, and I want to talk about that parameter, because I think this is an underreported and underdiscussed detail. It's if you can't find a policy that costs less than 8% of your income, then you're exempt. Do I have that right?
That's right.
So if you're that person making $50,000 a year, do the math, you're only required to buy insurance if you can find it for $4,000 or less.
That's correct.
Are policies at that price available?
Yes, particularly if you buy, if you're a younger person and you buy a catastrophic policy. And you can buy, in order to fulfill the requirement and avoid the penalty, you can buy a catastrophic policy, and almost certainly one will be available for that sum. Or even less. So that's that is a particular feature that was put into the law, especially for younger individuals with lower incomes, to enable them to get coverage. It's not the same comprehensive coverage because it's a catastrophic policy. It's not the same amount of financial protection that is available elsewhere through the insurance procured through the law. But nonetheless, it will allow you to fulfill the requirement to have insurance, pay less, and you will not have to avail yourself in that instance of the affordability exemption.
We're talking about the deadline coming next Monday for most Americans who don't currently have health insurance to sign up for insurance or face a fine, a penalty on your tax returns next year. Talking about it with Susan Denser, Senior Policy Advisor to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And here's an insurance broker calling in, Joy in Huntington. You're on WNYC. Hello, Joy.
Oh, yes. Hello. Am I on the air?
You are. And turn off your radio, otherwise you'll get confused
okay,
by the
I
delay.
Will. Your speaker is very informed, and it's taking a long time. I'm sure she's going nuts with all her information, but there is so much depravity. It's unbelievable. So, the real situations are the government is outreaching in just so many ways. Number one, we do have an industry that was bruised, and that is the broker insurance industry. And we do have now these non-for-profits that have offshoots of the government and have been in various states who have been providing health care to the Medicaid, who are now expanding and are in the broker division. Not to mention the compensation has basically been destroyed. There's no more compensation.
I don't want to get too far off on this tangent, but you're saying that Obamacare is bad for your industry, the certified insurance broker industry, because the business of signing people up for health insurance is migrating to others?
The business is not migrating to others. It's becoming completely government controlled. And in that, there is just inequity. There was never a discussion. There were never laws passed. I'm sure the government is going to be facing enormous amounts of lawsuits from private insurance companies. Who knows?
Can you as a broker set someone up with an Obamacare exchange policy?
Oh yes, I have a 5 broker of letters in my valise right now. But unfortunately, I'm going to pay a visit to a very sick Haitian employee that is a legitimate citizen who makes so far below, is in the poverty line, and has been declined disability. I don't want to get into my particulars in any way, but I am in the process of seeing so much poverty that I'm appalled. I can't believe the poverty and the status of the penalties. They're going to make the poverty even greater.
Joy, thank you for your call. But on that point, Susan Dentzer, and we talked earlier briefly about how there are hardship exemptions from having to buy health insurance and be covered. But if you really have financial hardship, if you're in poverty, then you're going to be eligible for Medicaid. So
yes.
Why is that exemption even relevant?
It is only relevant for a group of people who are frankly going to be, well, here's who it's relevant for. As we know, not all states have elected to expand their Medicaid programs. Only about half have. So there's going to be some pool of people who will arguably, for whatever reason, going to be able to be covered by Medicaid through particular states who may well fall into this situation where they will need to avail themselves of an affordability exemption, excuse me. There's a whole other class of people who could apply for these hardship exemptions. And again, it's quite detailed. It's you if you're homeless, if you were evicted in the past 6 months, if you got a shutoff notice from your utility, if you experienced domestic violence, if you had the death of a close family member and were so traumatized that you couldn't actually get yourself motivated to get coverage, if you were in a fire or a flood, if you filed for bankruptcy in the last 6 months, if you had medical expenses you couldn't pay in the last 2 years, if you expect that you're going to have a child who you will claim is a dependent who's been denied coverage in Medicaid and CHIP, and you cannot pay cover that child. You don't have to pay the penalty for that child. There are a lot of ways out of the payment of the penalty.
Let's see if Kylie in Bed-Stuy has one. I think she's calling about one. Kylie, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kylie. Nice to hear
Hello.
From you again.
I know. So my question is, I just signed up for the Affordable Care Act, and I understand that so I'll be billed monthly, and if I don't pay that bill, I think 2 consecutive months, then the insurance company can drop me and drop my coverage. So if that were to happen, because it is a really hefty payment, to be perfectly honest, if that were to happen so that by the end of 2014, I no longer have health insurance coverage, could I end up with both a tax penalty from the government and a medical bill and an insurance bill from the insurance company?
Wow. Susan, how about that scenario?
Well, assuming that you've stopped paying the premium, obviously you're not going to pay the premium, right? But in that case, if you're not able to check that box on when you submit your tax return next year, you're likely going to have to pay the penalty.
But what does the box actually ask you? Is it, did you have health insurance at any time during 2014, or did you have it on this particular date? Do you know how that's going to be worded?
I honestly don't, and my sense is it's worth checking the IRS website, which is, to make this even more complicated, that whole set of that whole provision and the penalty is administered through the IRS. So you could take a look now and see if the IRS has put out information about what the tax returns for the current calendar year, 2014, are going to look like. Obviously, right now, most people are focused on filing their taxes for 2013 and dealing with the 2013 forms. But we'll see how in fact, the IRS presents this on its 2014 forms.
We're talking about the coming March 31st, that's next Monday, deadline for most Americans to have health insurance. So if you're uninsured, that means signing up through the Obamacare exchanges. But I want to interrupt for just a second because we have some breaking news relevant to the segment that we started the show with about an hour ago. Osama bin Laden's son-in-law has been convicted of both counts in his case. That's conspiring to kill Americans by serving as al-Qaeda spokesman after the September 11th attacks and of providing material support to al-Qaeda. So the terrorism trial in Lower Manhattan of Salamoun Abu Ghaith has just ended with guilty verdicts on both counts by the jury. Thought you would like to know. But continuing with Susan Denser on Obamacare, I read that another exempt group, and watch this smooth segue into the Supreme Court story, another exempt group is people who have religious objections to having health insurance at all. I think you mentioned this briefly before, too. Do you know that to be true?
Yes. You have to file for those exemptions, however. So it's not as if there's a sort of a class, the government hasn't published a list of religions that you can be a member of and not have to have health insurance. If you want to find out more information about this, I heartily urge if you go to healthcare.gov/exemptions/, you will see a very detailed list for how to apply for these exemptions. And they include, it's not just religious beliefs. If you're in a so-called healthcare sharing ministry, if you are a member of a federally recognized tribe, Indian tribe, you can also apply, and you've got these options now of actually filling out the exemption application. And again, this is for you can get exempted on affordability grounds. You can get exempted on these hardship grounds that we've talked about, as well as religious beliefs, being a member of the tribe, et cetera. And all of that information is spelled out in great detail on the healthcare.gov site.
And briefly on the Supreme Court case yesterday. How do you think it went if you follow this? I realize you're a healthcare policy analyst. You're not a Supreme Court reporter or a legal eagle, but at issue was some for-profit companies' desire to not cover their employees for contraception, which the Affordable Care Act mandates be covered as part of basic universal health care. But once corporations start the law down that slope, the questions seem to go much deeper. Are they really arguing that any company can exempt themselves from any law of the United States based on the owner's religious beliefs? And can a corporation, as opposed to a person, be seen by the law as having a religion? So if you paid attention yesterday, Susan, how do you think it went for either side?
Well, as you suggested, the arguments were divided. The liberal, more liberal-leaning justices pressed very hard on the point that you made, which is that if you let companies get out of the responsibility to provide contraceptive coverage for religious beliefs, where does that stop? I mean, what else if they have a particular belief that somehow it's religiously wrong to enforce the minimum wage? Can they get out of that? So there was a lot of concern on the side of those liberal justices about that. Of course, as we know, the Supreme Court has ruled in another context that companies are people. In fact, they have the rights of persons with respect to free speech.
In the context
in political
of
context. So,
campaign finance.
Exactly right. So there was a lot of argument on that side. What's really, I think, was most interesting to me, again, as you say, I'm not a person who covers the Supreme Court, but what I think is interesting is that no one is challenging the notion that these two companies and the families that run them can have a religious belief, which is that some forms of contraception cause abortion, when in fact the science on that is so ambiguous. the issue seems to be that these companies feel that, for example, IUDs cause abortion, or that emergency contraceptive pills cause abortion, whereas in fact the science would suggest that what it most, for example, if you have IUDs with copper in them, it appears that the copper in them actually may prevent sperm from fertilizing an egg. So it's not as if there's ever even a fertilized egg, let alone the ability of a fertilized egg not to implant. So what is very curious to me, and certainly was remarkable, is that nobody is even talking about the science and all of that. That's completely beside the boards. It's if a company believes, the family that owns a closely held company believes something, therefore they can act on that belief in this way. And that frankly, was what I was most struck by.
And, of course, religious exemptions can cut both ways, politically, depending on the issue. During Vietnam, liberals argued for and won the right to have a personal conscientious objector status to being drafted without it having to be couched in a formal religion. But the government's view here is there could be a religious exemption to a person having health insurance at all, as you described, but not to a company offering all the benefits of basic health insurance as required by law. So I guess we'll see at the end of June what the Supreme Court decides. But we will see next Monday how many Americans have signed up by the year one open enrollment deadline. And just tell us before you go, Susan Dentzer, very briefly about this exemption that the president's people announced yesterday, or I should say extension. So some people will get an extension, but not very many people, where if they're in the system in some way, they can go beyond next Monday?
Yes. In fact, people will have now until about the end of April. And that is for, we should emphasize here, that's for people who had attempted to sign up through healthcare.gov, the federal exchange. There's also the situation in a number of states that have had problems with their own exchanges, Maryland, Minnesota, Nevada, et cetera. They have also independently extended the sign-up period. So individuals in a number of those states will have more time to sign up as well. It's a self-attestation is the phrase. It means what you basically have to do is say that you signed up or you were attempting to sign up and you had trouble signing up, and you'll be able to sign up, which means, I think, in effect, a little-known analysis that the government put out back at the beginning of March suggested that there were almost 9 million people who had gone on exchanges both at the federal and state level and were determined to be eligible to enroll. So if, in fact, many of those individuals stay with it, we could see a dramatically higher enrollment in the next couple of weeks, and particularly now that we know it's going to go on through most of April.
And so much is at stake with how many people do enroll, because the economic underpinning is based on a lot of young, healthy people actually enrolling, and that'll prevent the premiums for next year from going up too much, which would prevent more people from signing up if those premiums do go up too much. So it's very, very crucial to the long-term success of the system how many people sign up by next Monday, or for some by the end of that extended period that you just described. Susan Dentzer, Senior Policy Advisor to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, thank you so much for clearing so much up for so many listeners today. Thanks a lot.
Great to be with you.
Eu gosto dessa dança sensual que faz bumbum mexer, que faz bumbum mexer.
Now, a different kind of book interview on The Brian Lehrer Show, because my next guest has written a book about politics and global youth that comes complete with a playlist. Underneath me right now, Dança Sensual, a funk soundtrack to a Brazilian telenovela that is called A Mania for All Things Turkish in Brazil. Let's put that in context and hear a lot more with Columbia University International Affairs professor Hisham Aidi, author of Rebel Music, Race, Empire, and the New Muslim Youth Culture. Professor Aidi, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
And let's enter through the song we were just listening to, then we'll pull back to the bigger picture. Why is that on your playlist?
That is on my playlist because in the last decade, there has been a mania in Brazil and other parts of Latin America, a craze for music and culture from the Middle East. And what I say in the book is that it actually reflects Lula and Rousseff and their cultural diplomacy towards the region.
The progressive presidents of Brazil.
Right, the left-leaning presidents who made it a point that they would not partake in the war on terror. They would not implement the region-wide Patriot Act that Rumsfeld was asking for. And instead, they made it a point to reach out to Muslim communities, to celebrate these Muslim communities and their cultures, to visit mosques and so on. And this cultural diplomacy had a cultural pop aspect to it, a cultural manifestation, and it was manifested in telenovelas and carnival and music and so on.
And listeners, we've put the Rebel Music playlist on our page. Hear it on your own time at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. But let's stay right on that theme. Here's another one in which the Mideast meets Latin America. You call this a Lebanese-Cuban collaboration. Listen, folks, for the Latin intro and then the Middle Eastern vocal. So you really hear the Middle Eastern vocal and the Latin-Cuban arrangement.
Right. It's a very curious admixture of tropicalism and orientalism that became popular after 2002, 2003 in Latin America. And this is partly, again, because of the rise of the left in Latin America, but also because a number of these heads of states who came to power made it a point to distance themselves from war on terror policies and claim solidarity with the developing world, with the Muslim world. And this was a cultural manifestation, all kinds of cultural diplomatic initiatives seen in telenovelas, seen in music, seen in collaborations such as this, Hanin Son.
And what exactly was that piece, and who's the artist?
Was Hanin y Su Son, which is a Cuban. It's a collaboration, a group from Havana and a group from Lebanon. Hanin is the vocalist, and Son Cubano from Havana.
And we'll hear more musical examples in a minute. But the subtitle of your book is Race, Empire, and the New Muslim Youth Culture. What is this new Muslim youth culture? Is it global rather than specific to different nations?
It is global. I'm particularly interested in the Muslim communities of Western Europe, North America, sort of these communities that have come under stress because of war and terror policies, pincered between, you know, conservative Islamist movements, surveillance states, and American power. Where do you go? And one of the things I argue is that Muslim youth today, questions of belonging have been sharpened, heightened, and a number of these youth are gravitating towards the African diaspora, the cultures of the African diaspora, and the black freedom struggles of the New World. And so I begin the book in Crotona Park in the Bronx, talking about how kids will come from different France, from Germany, from Argentina, and so on, to visit the Bronx and to dip into the rich heritage of African-American Islam.
That was a great opening scene for the book. The Bronx, the summer of 2003, and you had this working-class kid from Marseille, France, discovering what you call the moral geography of his life in the Bronx.
Right. All teared up, choked up, talking about how, you know, hip-hop made my life. Hip-hop has connected us with, you know, similarly marginalized people from the, you know, the banlieues of Marseille, Paris, to, you know, Chicago and South America. And so I talk about the role of hip-hop and how hip-hop has become more political in Muslim communities, and for that reason, governments are trying to regulate it. The French government primarily, but also other governments, Germany, Holland, and the U.S., more at the foreign policy level.
Regulate hip-hop?
Yes. France actually passed a law in 1994, the Droit Carignan, which limited the amount of American hip-hop that could be played on French airwaves. Their concern back then was Americanization. Their fear was English words creeping into the French language. Right? That was just 20 years ago. Today, they're more concerned about radicalism, leftism. And so they're trying to promote some hip-hop artists over others, right? And I talk in the book about how they're trying to marginalize people such as Medine, who are hard left, black power inspired, and promoting others.
And we're going to play an example of each, I think, in just a second. Again, my guest is Columbia University International Affairs Professor Hisham Aidi. His new book is Rebel Music, Race, Empire, and the New Muslim Youth Culture. And he sent us a list of 23 tracks that we might sample from to exemplify some of the music and cultural circumstances that he writes about in the book. You can see that whole playlist at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. I had so much fun listening last night and this morning to these tunes, many of which I did not know. And so you'll discover some great stuff for yourself if you're into world music. So this next track from your playlist is from the Kominas, who you call Pakistani-American punk rockers, responding to the Bush, Blair, Musharraf policy of using Sufism for de-radicalization. You want to explain that before we play the clip?
Sure. After 9/11, 2003, the RAND Corporation, the Nixon Center, a number of think tanks in Washington, D.C. began producing reports, policy memos, arguing that the sources of the political violence directed at the U.S. are theological, religious, ideological, and what we should do to counter the Salafi movement, the Taliban, and so on, is mobilize folk Islam, Sufism, often described as the more mystical branch of Islam. And so this was the policy. National Intelligence Council would set up a program, $1.3 billion, called Transforming Islam from Within. And at the heart of this policy, which would be embraced not only by the U.S., but a number of governments sort of to counter ultra-conservative Islamists, was music. Music was at the heart of policy. Through music, you can disseminate Sufism. Through Sufi practice, Sufi culture, you can disseminate a more liberal Islam. So what, you want me to continue?
This is a response to that movement in music from the Pakistani-American punk rockers, the Kominas. Can you translate the lyrics here, and are they specifically relevant to what you were just describing?
Well, what they're talking about love and survival in Iraq and in Karbala, and they're singing in Punjabi, and these are three kids from Boston, anarchist punk rockers who, you know, they begin raising hell domestically, challenging conservative Muslim attitudes towards music, but then they go off and challenge the Musharraf government for exploiting the Sufi heritage for this. ਜਨ ਕਾ ਚੁਕੋ ਜਿੱਦੀ ਵੋਟੀ ਚੰਗੀ ਆ ਉਹਦਾ ਦੁਕਾਨ ਲੁੱਟੋ ਖੇਡ 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 ਕੇ ਕੱਟੀ ਪੂਰੀ ਜਿੰਦੜੀ ਜੂਆ ਖੇਡ 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 ਕੇ ਕੱਟੀ ਪੂਰੀ ਜਿੰਦੜੀ The Kominas.
So here's the flip side. Here's an example of what you were just describing that this is a reaction to. Abdul Malik with Gibraltar, and you call Abdul Malik a French Muslim rapper and Sufi spoken word artist, considered moderate and celebrated by the French state.
Sur le détroit de Gibraltar, il y a un jeune noir qui pleure un rêve qui prendra vie une fois passé Gibraltar. Sur le détroit de Gibraltar, il y a un jeune noir qui se demande si l'histoire le retiendra comme celui qui portait le nom de cette montagne.
How's your French?
Pretty good.
What's he saying?
He's talking about how there's a young man on the Straits of Gibraltar, and this young man is at peace with himself, and he's basically narrating his life, right? This is Abdul Malik. 15, 20 years ago, he was a street hustler. Then he became an Islamist, joining a group called the Jamaat Tablighi. He had a successful rap career with a group called New African Poets, but then he became an Islamist, abandoned rap altogether. And then he had a Sufi conversion, right, a Sufi transformation. He becomes a Sufi and sort of becomes apolitical. And the music that he does is, as you see, jazz riffs, chanson française, and spoken word. And he's probably the most celebrated French rap artist of the last decade. The cultural establishment has embraced him, given him every award imaginable, because they see the music that he does is representative of a moderate Islam, an Islam that can be let into the public sphere.
But it's also an indication of how there is political diversity, cultural diversity within global Muslim youth when you take the song that we just heard and the one right before it.
Absolutely. And another thing to say is Abdul Malik is a great artist, but ever since he's been embraced by the French cultural establishment, he's lost the street, right? He's no longer, he was incredibly popular when he was with the New African Poets. But now that he's invited to the presidential palace and given all kinds of awards, he's seen as a top-down figure, right? Somebody imposed, an imposed artist.
How does he feel about that?
Well, you know, he's constantly battling with, you know, artists who are telling him he's lost his street cred. But he says, I represent the true spirit of Islamic reconciliation. And the Islam I represent is the one that's compatible with the French Republic's values.
Well, is there anything that you would call an indigenous Muslim youth protest music against the excesses of violent radical Islam? I mean, lots of Americans write protest songs about the excesses of, you know, American religious fundamentalism and American imperialism. There's British protest music by Brits, et cetera, against British state violence. What about a Muslim youth movement against Salafists and other radicals that doesn't have to be seen as top-down and promoted by the state?
Well, and we were talking earlier about the Kaminas. The Kaminas were responding to the Junoon, a Pakistani group, which was in effect doing just that, right? They were playing sort of indigenous, local, you know, they were playing rock mixed with Sufi poetry, responding to the Taliban.
Junoon's been on the show. Yeah.
Junoon was doing that.
Doing that.
Right. They were doing that. So they were seen as a protest group in the 1990s, right? When they were protesting the Nawaz Sharif government. But then Musharraf comes to power, and they become too close to him, right? And they become part of his Sufi agenda.
Uh-huh.
And that's when you get the Taqwa Corps and the Kaminas protesting against Junoon, who were seen as having lost their street credibility.
Hisham Aidi, Columbia University International Affairs professor, author of Rebel Music, Race, Empire, and the New Muslim Youth Culture. Here's a really unusual historical clip, something different from your playlist. It's a French-Algerian vaudeville tune from the 1930s. You want to set this up for us and tell us why you include it in relation to this book about contemporary culture?
Which one is this?
This is going to be, I'll tell you in a second, this is going to be Mohammed El-Kama.
Right, so that song, it's a hilarious song. It's called Tic Tic Tac, Mohamed El Kamal. It was an Algerian band leader, lived in France in the 1920s and 30s, just as Algerian migration increases after World War I. And he writes this track basically mixing, you know, the sounds of vaudeville, big band, rumba, with his Andalusian training, right? The music of, you know, Andalusia from North Africa. And he would write jingles, and this is one of the jingles, right? He writes a jingle about the invention of the telephone, being a carpet seller in Paris, and this is about his heart beating for his loved one.
Vintage 1930s. قلبي يعمل تيك تيك تاك نحبك نعشق في زينك يا محلاك كي شوف قلبي يعمل تيك تيك تاك نحبك نعشق في زينك يا محلاك هبلت هبلتيني تيك تيك تاك.
His heart is pounding.
For what?
For his loved one, right? His love is drowning him, and, you know, and so on.
So it's an example from that era of fusion?
It's an example of a number of things, right? It was actually French record owners who would go down to North Africa to the colonies and, quote-unquote, discover artists and then bring them back to perform at the World Expo in 1937 in Paris, a huge cultural phenomenon. And it is at the World Expo where Mohamed El-Kamal meets Hamid Bashtarzi and Salim Hilali. And the three of them would go on to create an extraordinary sound that would change the sound of North Africa for decades to come, basically mixing Andalusian music, which was becoming the music of the nationalist movements in North Africa, mixing it with rumba and big band and so on, and triggering all kinds of debates.
And let's play a Salim Hilali clip, because this will really scramble people's brains. This is the song My Yiddish Mama, sung in Arabic, and it's both authentically Arab and authentically Jewish. Set this up for us.
Right, Salim Hilali, he was born in Annaba, Algeria. He boards his ship from Algiers to Marseille at the age of 14, dreaming of becoming a flamenco singer, singing flamenco in Arabic. He meets Mohamed El-Kamal, who becomes his songwriter, and he would become a star in the Latin Quarter, singing in the cabarets there. And the song that you're about to hear, he did after the 67 War, right? A very difficult time when the Jewish communities of North Africa were leaving, and the song is based on the vaudeville song from the 1920s, which imagines an old, sort of the anxiety of assimilation and imagining life in the old world through love for the Jewish mother. He does the same thing, but imagining sort of an Arabic-speaking past, sort of the end of this era of the Jewish communities of North Africa, the Arabic-speaking Jewish communities of North Africa.
chez ma mère. يا اللي وحشت لي قلبي.
My Yiddish mama, unlike you've heard it at your grandmother's wedding. I guess you weren't at your grandmother's wedding. Who's the audience? Who's applauding there?
The audience is largely North African migrants.
Jews from North Africa.
And Muslim, right? Who are sort of who've left their homelands, given the post-colonial conflict of these regions. And this was also one of the earliest music videos done in France. Right. And the reason I put them on the playlist is there's a revival, there's a very keen interest in the music of the North African Jews who migrated to France today.
By whom?
The younger generation, largely Muslims, who believe that the sounds of these exiled artists can help calm tensions in France today, can help calm some of the memory war, the memory competition taking place in Europe today.
How do you know all this music? Do you travel and collect? Are there radio station streams from around the world you listen to online? How do you know all this?
Yes, yes, and yes. I do travel. I do collect. I've been a crate digger for many years, and I was a DJ in my youth.
Does protest music have more political impact in some countries than others, either with the government or to frame the politics of youth culturally?
I think that when governments intervene, very often they can rob that protest music of its content, right? So in countries that are more democratic and the state leaves these artists alone, they can have more of an impact.
Is freedom of speech an issue for the artists you write about, or any of them underground
sure.
in jail?
Absolutely, which is why technology-wise, the internet has completely revolutionized the practice of music. A number of the rap artists I talk about, such as Medine, those considered radical. I mean, in every Western European state today, there's a good Muslim artist and a bad Muslim artist. And a number of those Muslim rappers who are considered radical and left-wing exist on the internet. It's technology that has liberated them.
What do you hope people take away from this book, bottom line?
The stories, I'm talking about genres and music from South America to South Asia, just to explain how diverse the Muslim community is, these Muslim communities are, the challenges that they're facing. And the book is about cultural policy and public diplomacy and the rise of social movements that are trying to deal with these rather punitive policies that are being directed at the Muslim community.
Hisham Aidi, Columbia University International Affairs professor, now the author of Rebel Music, Race, Empire, and the New Muslim Youth Culture. Let's go out with one more clip from your playlist, a Belgian-American Congolese band you call one of the hottest acts on the Muslim hip-hop scene.
Yep.
What's this?
This is The Reminders, two individuals, Big Samir, who's Belgian-Congolese, moved to America, and Asia Black from Brooklyn, an amazing act. They've toured the world.
Thanks for the thoughts. Thanks for the tunes.
Thank you.
Simple, even though pops was not around and mama had to struggle. Surviving in the ghetto, we hustle, that's universal. Like an international plague, I hit us in the middle of the body. My community's been torn apart. I was told if you want to change, you gotta start with the heart. Then you see clear both sides, light and dark. Time to make a decision. Speed up or slow down.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Former President Jimmy Carter has become convinced that deprivation and abuse of women and girls is the most serious and most unaddressed problem in the world and results from a false interpretation of carefully selected religious texts. President Carter is here in our studio to talk about that and more, including perhaps why he sends snail mail, not email, to world leaders, which he said on television the other day. You can probably guess why. His new book is A Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. Mr. President, an honor. Welcome to our Varick Street home.
It's good to be with you again, Brian. Thank you.
You and I have spoken about religion before in the context of your faith and your lifetime of teaching the Bible. So why point to religion now as a prime cause of what you call the most serious problem in the world?
Well, religion and violence are the two generic causes of the abuse of women and girls around the world. And it's a misinterpretation of some of the scriptures that result in abuse of women and derogation of them in the eyes of men because they are convinced that women are inferior in the eyes of God. And for religious people even, that are Christians, for instance, we know that Jesus Christ in his ministry and his words, all the recorded words, He never discriminated against women. In fact, he exalted women far above what they had ever been previously in history. But even in the New Testament, where St. Paul began to write to the early churches, he wrote to individuals, sometimes little tiny churches that had 20 or 30 members, and some of his verses can be interpreted either way. So for the first three centuries in the Christian church, at least, women played an equal role, as Paul points out in his 16th chapter of Acts. But after that, the men who ran the church began to say, why don't we select other verses which show that women are not qualified to be priests or deacons in the church. And
Can you give me an example of either of these verses on either side of this?
Well, yeah. In fact, Paul said to one of his small churches that women should always never adorn themselves, that women should be silent in church. And there's even a verse that says women shouldn't teach men. But on the other hand, he said that in the eyes of God, men and women are equal, as are slaves and masters, and are Jews and Gentiles. They are equal in the eyes of God. And as I just mentioned in the 16th chapter that I mentioned, he lists about 25 people who were preeminent in leadership roles in the early church, and about half of them are women by name. So you can interpret it either way you want to if you have a preference. But there are 36,000 verses, more or less, in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew text, and in the New Testament. So you can interpret any way you want to.
In today's world, is this mostly a radical Islam problem? Certainly we can find the conservative Christian and the history you were just describing, or the Orthodox Jewish, or other religions practices that are sexist and cause harm to women and girls. But maybe there's nothing like the terrorist attacks and other military campaigns aimed at depriving girls in education and other things, Taliban, things going on in Nigeria, et cetera, a tiny minority of Muslims, we should say, involved in global terms, but still at a unique scale and intensity compared to other religions?
Well, I've studied the Quran probably more than most people have in the United States that are not Muslims. When they were holding our hostages in Iran, I really made a dedicated effort to understand the Quran. And I had experts come into the Oval Office and teach me about the nuances of it. And it's very difficult to find a verse in the Quran that doesn't emphasize the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah, as interpreted by Muhammad. But obviously, there are interpretations of that by the Taliban and others that deprive women of an equal right. Most of the problems that that afflict women and girls are not from the religious text, but sometimes that's the basis for them, as I've already mentioned. But for instance, I'd say the worst unknown crime against women and girls is the murder of little girls by their parents. When a girl is born, they strangle her because they want a boy. And now with the advent—
For economic reasons?
For economic reasons, and also because some countries like China and India and others have put a limit on the total size of families. One is best, two is most. And so if they only have one child, they want to make sure that it's a boy. And also they don't have Social Security like we do, so they want boys in the family so they can earn a living to support the parents when they're old age. So they look at a family in an area of poverty, and they say, we can only feed two children, so they strangle the rest of them. There's a new movie out called It's a Girl. It was premiered in November. There's a mother in India who very proudly says, in effect, that she strangled eight daughters when they were born because she had to have a son. And we know that in many areas, if there's only one opportunity to send a child to school, they send the boy. If they have a limited amount of food, the boys get first choice. And the other thing is that there are now about 160 million missing girls on Earth because either the baby at birth or the fetus in a selective abortion have been eliminated. And this has resulted in China and India, in effect, in a very great shortage of women to be married to men or to satisfy the men's sexual desires in a brothel and so forth. And this is another ancillary terrible problem about it.
My guest is former President Jimmy Carter. His new book, A Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. And listeners, President Carter will take some phone calls here today. If there is anything you've always wanted to ask Jimmy Carter, but he wasn't around your dining room table, now's your chance. 212-433-WNYC. And this can be on his book, A Call to Action, or anything else from World Affairs Today or even from his presidency. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Of course, we'll ask you to keep your questions brief and to the point, and we'll see if we can get some of you in here for Jimmy Carter, former President of the United States, on the phones. 212-433-9692. Am I right that you and Mrs. Carter left your Christian denomination of 70 years over women's issues?
Yes. In the year 2000, the Southern Baptist Convention deviated from its previous policy and ordained that women, in being inferior, could not occupy the positions of pastor or deacon or chaplain, and they also even ordained it in some of the seminaries, which is the higher education level of a Southern Baptist church, that women couldn't even teach boys in a classroom.
So it's not even just that they're not coming along as fast as some other denominations. It's that even in the post-feminist era, if you will, they went the other way.
They went the other way in the year 2000, and so my wife and I left the Southern Baptist Convention. We now belong to a Baptist church where I teach Bible lessons every Sunday, as a matter of fact. And we've had women pastors, and my wife is a deacon. The chairman of our board of deacons the last time was a woman, and we have a majority of deacons who's a women. So we treat men and women equally, which I believe that Jesus Christ always exemplified and promulgated as his policy.
Gee, if they don't want women teaching men and boys, maybe we can get more males into the teaching profession.
Well, you certainly can in the Southern Baptist Seminary.
I guess so, if nowhere else. Mr. President, put on your headphones, and you can hear some of our callers that way. Our lines are already full at 212-433-WNYC. And maybe we can get somebody to come and help you with those headphones. We're going to get a producer in here to help untangle those phones. Oh, now you got them. All right. Kevin in Ridgewood, you're on WNYC with President Jimmy Carter. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Good morning, Kevin.
Hi, President Carter. My question is based upon your book, and it's based upon where does the solution begin? Because obviously it's not a denouncing of religion, but it's looking for a change in views and how scriptures are interpreted.
That's true, Kevin, and I want to point out that in the book, there are 23 different specific recommendations that I give to assuage the abuse of women all over the world. And it ought to start in our own country, because here we have a terrible abuse of women and girls. For instance, in our two most respected, institutions, the university system and in our military, that's where sexual abuse is most prevalent and is least brought to the attention of authorities. Because a college president and the deans of a college, even Emory University where I teach or Harvard or whatever, they don't want to have a reputation in their universities that sexual abuse is increasing. And we know that in the year 2000, where statistics have been promulgated, the same thing has applied in the military. 26,000 cases of sexual abuse were finally revealed when the military was forced to do so. Only about 300 of those resulted in a conviction or punishment of the rapist, which is about 1%. And in a college campus, only about 4% of the total rapes are reported to the authorities, which is about 1/6 as much as takes place within the general population. So the United States has a long way to go to correct these problems, and I certainly don't want to say I'm a very devout Christian. I think that if we all turn to the teachings of Christ, as I just said, we would be very open and dedicated to the equality of treatment of women, and would correct the problem that exists.
Jim in Bricktown, you're on WNYC with former President Carter. Hello.
Hello, and a great honor to talk to President Carter. I was over the weekend, there was online a projected piece of legislation in Iraq to allow men to marry girls as young as 9. And one of the projected responses was sanctions. And I was wondering, well, first of all, Iraq had sanctions between the first Gulf War and the second incursion. So do sanctions work, and or would they make the country more isolated and culturally backward?
Jim, we have had Carter Center programs in 79 different countries on Earth, and we've gotten to know what goes on in those countries. And quite often, if there's a local cultural commitment, like to circumcising girls or mutilating their genitals, or to promote multiple marriages or to marry their children, an outsider who tries to make them change, quite often that's counterproductive. It's better for them to change on their own. As a matter of fact, there are about 125 million girls who are married at an age all the way from 8 years old up to early teens each year. And this is accepted in many cultures around the world. And I think that this is something that it would not be resolved, to answer your specific question, by any kind of sanctions or punishment from outside to that culture.
Former President Jimmy Carter here, his new book, A Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. And let me touch on a few other current issues with you, if I might. And speaking of macho men and sanctions for that matter, how do you see Vladimir Putin in historical terms? You were president during the Cold War. Is he the latest expression of a centuries-long Russian expansionism? Or how do you see Putin in historical terms?
Well, in a way, I see him similar to what I saw Brezhnev when I was president, when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. And I wanted to make certain that they didn't go any further. So I immediately withdrew the American ambassador. I declared an embargo against Russia, Soviet Union then. I approved the action of the Congress and the Olympic Committee to withdraw from the Olympics, which is very important to them.
1980 Olympics.
Yes, and recently to Putin. And I also let Brezhnev know with a public statement that if he went any further than Afghanistan, that we would take military action to stop that invasion. And then we began secretly to give weapons to the freedom fighters in Afghanistan, which eventually resulted in the Soviets having to withdraw under Gorbachev. Putin was dedicated to taking over Crimea. I don't think that any outside force could have prevented that taking place, because most of the Crimeans wanted to go into the Russian orbit. But I think that now he has to be stopped. And I watched with great attention last week, I think, when he made a speech saying we're not going to do that in eastern Crimea. Eastern Ukraine. But Crimea is going to be part of Russia, no matter what anybody on the outside does. I think that what Putin is going to do now is try to woo the people in eastern Ukraine who are Russian-speaking and so forth, with blandishments, with good trade, with loans and grants, easy traffic to and from Russia and so forth. I think he's going to try to seduce them to believing that they will be better off in an alliance with Russia than the West.
You know, some people say the current crisis is as much the West's fault for pushing NATO membership all the way to Russia's doorstep since the Cold War, and boxing Russia in and making it feel defensive. Do you support that theory at all?
I can see the justification for the theory, with which I don't agree. As I mentioned earlier, I believe that Putin was dedicated to taking Crimea no matter what happened. And I don't think that anything could have deterred him from doing so.
Mina in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Jimmy Carter. Hello, Mina.
Good morning, and thank you for giving me this opportunity. I'm just calling to really sincerely thank the president for being so active in helping all over the world, and also being a superb human being. And thank you for this opportunity for giving to me to express my feeling towards him. I love him, and God bless you and keep you safe and healthy for the rest of your life.
Well, thank you. That's the kind of question I like.
Yeah, you got a big smile out of Jimmy Carter, Mina.
I love him. I just love him. Kiss him for me.
I'll let that be a virtual kiss. Maybe I'll give him a hug. Pamela in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Mr. President.
Good morning, Pamela.
My question is this.
As a humanitarian, I'm wondering how you feel about the law whereby corporations have been designated as people.
I don't agree with it at all. I think one of the worst mistakes that the Supreme Court of the United States has ever made as far as political justification and equality in our country is to declare that corporations are the same as human beings. And the Citizens United ruling, I think, has been one of the major causes of an almost total deadlock within the Congress when massive amounts of money, some of it coming from overseas, can be poured into the campaigns to be spent mostly on negative advertisements. So I think it was a devastating blow to the integrity of our democratic system.
Pamela, thank you. You told NBC on Sunday that you use snail mail, old-fashioned paper letters, to communicate with world leaders because you think the NSA is spying on your electronic communication. Did you think that before Edward Snowden?
Yes, I did. You know, when I was president, I was very concerned about the intrusion on private affairs of the intelligence agencies of our country. I knew what was going on as president. So I sponsored the passage of the bill known as the FISA Act, which meant that the intelligence agencies couldn't interrogate or intercede any sort of communication between two American citizens unless applying to an individual citizen they got a ruling from the justices that were appointed that it was necessary for security reasons. But then I think after 9/11, my FISA Act was completely distorted and liberalized so that it made possible additional intrusions. Some of the members of the Congressional Intelligence Committees understood, but most of the members of the House and Senate didn't even know what was going on. And I think that NSA and others have gone even beyond that in liberally interpreting the law that did exist. I think that the recommendations of the 40 or so distinguished members that President Obama appointed, I hope they'll be carried out. And I noticed that in the news this morning, he's going to stop the recording of almost every telephone call or email message in America, which has been going on and been retained by the NSA.
And so you would support that? As the New York Times describes it this morning, the president would end the NSA systematic collection of data, as you say, about Americans' calling habits. Those bulk records would stay in the hands of the phone companies, which would not be required to retain the data for any longer than they normally would. And the NSA could obtain specific records only with the permission of a judge using a new kind of court order. Is that good in your opinion? I guess you're saying it is. Does it threaten our national security at all, which is the concern on the other side?
I don't think it does, and I would go even further than that. I don't think that the NSA ought to record every message, even if they turn it over to the private telephone companies. I don't think they ought to record my messages when I want to communicate with my grandchildren or with another politician.
And they're not recording the messages, right? What number called what number, when and for how long?
But if they want to go back and get that message, they can tell exactly what you said. And I think that kind of thing ought to be severely limited.
Jane in Park Slope, you're on WNYC with Jimmy Carter. Hello.
Hi, fellas. And Jimmy, God bless you for the wonderful things you've done around the world for over the years. You're going to the top of heaven in my book.
Thank you, Jane.
I hope, especially since you're touching on issues that affect women around the world, I hope that something can be done in Western countries to counter the problems I see, especially for young women, that are caused by the media's heavy influence on sexual activity and also the use of younger and younger girls and young women in advertising and pornography.
And Jane, forgive me, I'm going to leave it there and get President Carter's reaction to your critique of U.S. media.
Jane, one of the things that I haven't mentioned yet that takes place in the United States is a horrible degree of slavery. And that results indirectly, at least, from what you just described. We have a terrible number of young girls that are sold into slavery in this country every year, according to the statistics from the U.S. State Department, about 100,000. And the worst place on America for young girls to be sold into slavery is in Atlanta, Georgia, because we have the largest airport on earth. And we also have passengers coming in from the poorer countries in the southern hemisphere. in Latin America and Africa and so forth. And an average girl can be got into slavery and sold in Atlanta for $1,000. If they come from Europe and so forth, it costs up to $8,000. And the New York Times last week had a report that the prostitution industry in Atlanta alone was $290 million a year. And so this is what's happening in our country. So slavery now far exceeds what it did in the 19th century as far as the number of dollars involved, about $32 billion, and the number of people who are actually in slavery, which is now about 29 million in the world.
We actually talked about this on yesterday's show with the author Holly Austin Smith, who just wrote a book about sex slavery in the United States.
In the United States. And we could
among underage girls, among children, really. And but when you say slavery,
yeah,
people will think of the plantation system before the Civil War. What does slavery in 2014 that you're referring to look like?
These are people living in bondage where they don't have any control over their own activities and they're forced by a master who dominates them.
In the United States?
Yes, in the United States and around the world, of course. But I'm talking about the United States right now. But a woman, a young girl who's sold into slavery, has no control over her activities. She's a victim of a brothel owner or a pimp. And she's also a victim of the male customers who frequent her and pay her to do it. And there's hardly a whorehouse or a brothel in America that's not known by the existing authorities. The mayor, the city council, the policemen know when a house of prostitution exists. And quite often the policemen in charge of that particular block or street, they either get paid a bribe or they look the other way. Or they are given sexual privileges free. And so this is something that we need to do. In America, we're particularly vulnerable because 50 times as many prostitutes, the innocent girls quite often, are arrested as are brothel owners or pimps or male customers. In other countries like Sweden, they now do not ever arrest a prostitute. But they do arrest male customers as well as pimps and brothel owners. And that is really working in reducing the level of prostitution.
We have just a few minutes left with former President Carter. I know you have to go to your next appointment. In fact, is it a book appearance?
Yeah, this will be my first book signing, as a matter of fact, at Barnes & Noble.
Which Barnes & Noble? Do you know?
Let me
see if we can get – we're going to look it up and tell everybody where you can meet President Carter at noon, I think. Is that right?
Yes, it is.
Just tell me briefly, on John Kerry's negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians, do you see success as possible?
I think it's possible, yes. And I think John Kerry's made the most notable effort maybe in the last 15 years or so. And he's been now recently, I think, we've seen some signs that President Obama is supporting him in a more public way. But I'm really filled with admiration and gratitude to John Kerry for his great effort.
A big concern for the Israelis is always that if they give up military control of the West Bank, a Palestinian army or police force will not be willing to dismantle terrorist cells that still want to attack Israel. Gaza, after Israeli withdrawal, is unfortunately seen as a cautionary tale. What provision in a treaty do you think could address that major stumbling block?
I think the Palestinians will accept a demilitarization of the Palestinian state. I think they will also accept troops being sent in from the United States and from Europe and even from Israel to make sure that there's no violence that is organized or directed against Israel. And I don't think it's necessary for the Israeli military to retain control over all of the West Bank, including the eastern area of it, that in the Jordan River Valley.
One more call to wrap it up. Don in New Milford, you're on WNYC with President Carter. Hi.
Hello, Mr. Letter. Hello, Mr. President.
Good morning. Good Don.
I think it's a wonderful opportunity. President Carter, I voted for you. I think you're a wonderful person.
Thank you for that.
And the things you do for people are amazing. Your naval service, I always got very interested in that. What years did you serve in the Navy, President Carter?
I served in the Navy from 1943 until 1953. And I was on battleships and three submarines, and I spent the last part of my career as a submarine officer.
I have one more question, President Carter. Did you once say that you witnessed a UFO in Puerto Rico?
I witnessed a UFO in South Georgia, but it was an unidentified flying object, and I've made reports on that a lot of times. It was just a light in the sky that looks about like the moon that changed the colors and then disappeared. And we never did identify what that object was, but I don't claim that it came from outer space. I don't claim that it was a vehicle or something like that, but it was unidentified, it was flying, and it was an object.
October 1st this year will be your 90th birthday. Considering the seriousness of the problems you document in your new book, do you think humanity has made real progress during your lifetime toward becoming a race of just and merciful beings? Or are we simply who we are, no more compassionate, no less warlike, because that's human nature?
I think there are more wars going on now, either bilateral wars or ones quite often initiated from America, than there were before the United Nations was formed. And I also think that the abortion of selective abortion of girls has resulted in a much more wide death rate among little girls than it was, say, 50 years ago. In some areas, we're making progress, obviously, more equality of treatment, but I don't think that the world in general has improved itself on the treatment of girls and women.
Former President Jimmy Carter, his new book, A Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. And such an honor to have you in our studio here at WNYC. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.